If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. It's Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Tuesday afternoon, the last Tuesday before Christmas, which means most of you are listening to us from the mall. John Najarian is on a phone line from CNBC and at Option Monster at Twitter.com. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Yep, here at the New York Stock Exchange right now, in fact.
Oh, good for you. So you can do some custom shopping there. Bring us home some New York Stock Exchange T-shirts for Christmas.
You need some paraphernalia? I'll bring it back for you, Stephen.
What's happened there? Because it looks like things have started to cook maybe in the past half hour or so.
Yeah, I can't exactly explain why, but the market did catch a very significant bid about 35, 40 minutes ago. And the Dow is up 125 at mid-session. NASDAQ and the Russell and basically S&P 500 all moving to the upside nicely here.
So we saw a revised GDP figure out today, right? The revised downward to 2%, which I guess wasn't a huge shock when it comes to expectations. But then the existing home sales was down quite a bit more than people were expecting.
Yeah, that was. Although, one thing interesting about that, the ITB, this is an ETF that tracks, it's the Dow Jones Home Construction ETF, and it's up 1% today. So it has more than the S&P 500 home builder ETF. This one is really just the home builders, whereas the other one is a lot of the support, the Home Depots and many of the people that go into supporting home construction and so forth. This one is actual home builders primarily, and that's up 1% here today. Certainly a really nice move out of that, despite the idea that, as you say, the market was somewhat surprised by how weak those numbers were.
And I know part of the weaker number had to do with some changing in government regulation or something that delayed some of the turnaround, so this 1 month might be a bit of an anomaly, but still the number's a little bit lower than expected.
And lower for longer still is, I believe, going to play out. And you started off, Stephen, with that GDP number down around the 2% level. That'll be something that keeps the Fed from making 5 rate hikes next year because they won't want to be hiking into that environment. They might still move 2 or 3 times in 2016, but the likelihood that they'll make 4 or 5 hikes, which is what the market had feared, and you saw that reflected over the last 3 days of last week, that seems to be abating a little bit here.
All right, so I know you market guys love charts, and you know, John, what I look sometimes when I look at a chart, it's hard for my brain to sort of grasp it. But there's a piece on Money Watch or Market Watch today, which kind of grabbed my attention. It has to do with the fact that the Dow is down about 3% for the year, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so they went back to 1933, and they say in every pre-presidential election year, if you look at that, the average gain in the Dow has been about 10.4%. The idea, you know, that the president does well, or just before an election, for some reason, the average is 10.4%. The last time in a pre-election year that the Dow finished the year down was 1939, so it's almost always in positive territory, and it looks as if this year it will be a negative. I don't know what that means. Does that mean anything at all to you?
Well, there are certain trends that I do like to play, and many of those did not work out this year. One of them, Stephen, is that you buy the retailers in the Labor Day time frame, and you sell it in the Black Friday of November, right after the day after Thanksgiving. That trend didn't work out either. So just like the one you're describing, there have been some disruptions in what normally are pretty defined trends that occur year in and year out. However, this anomaly or this divergence from what has been normal in the past, I don't know if I want to read too much into that. We also haven't had a zero interest rate policy even back in 1939, but that's what we have here, and we've just moved off of it to a quarter of 1%, which I still think is very accommodative.
It's interesting the way you look at it versus the way I did, because you were looking at it like it might have been a way to play come January 1st of last year, like we tend to see gains in a pre-election year. I was looking at it as to what it might portend for the future, and there's probably no way to figure that out. CNBC is out with its millionaire survey for the fall, and they talk about what they expect next year from the S&P. Let me see here. Less than half the millionaires surveyed think the S&P 500 will be up between 5 and 10% next year. About 25% think it will be flat for 2016. What do you think about those numbers?
Well, I guess I'm not surprised. The millionaires, I spoke to Robert Frank, our reporter, who I believe was at front and center at putting that together, and he does the Wealth Watch and other great reporting over at CNBC. A lot of the millionaires are, of course, already very exposed to real estate, and so their willingness to do further real estate investment is nil at this point. And instead, they're really looking at bonds and interest rates, as well as, of course, stocks. And because of the performance of this past year in stocks, they're somewhat soured on that as well. In other words, they're not plowing as much money into that. So or at least that's what they're saying when they talk to people. I think if they're exposed through their wealth manager, whoever that might be, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, or some private wealth manager at an independent firm, I think they are still in the market. I don't know that any of them have liquidated in any large numbers. So I would think that they're going to be riding the same wave the rest of us will into 2016 and hopefully a decent market in 2016.
Should the average investor, the sub-millionaire, follow what millionaires do, or is it just a completely different ballgame when it comes to that?
Well, as I say, because I think millionaires are so exposed to real estate, I think if people had cash available and they weren't leveraging themselves with these interest rates, there is a pretty compelling reason with the rents you can get to own some sort of rental property, whether it's a two-flat, doesn't have to be a 50-unit building. But even a two-flat at low interest rates should be pretty attractive, with especially the Chicagoland area seeing rents moving up as much as they have, with some of the lack of access to loans that would allow others to buy their own abode. I think that's still going to be a trend that continues in 2016.
That's not John Najarian. You know him at Option Monster or see him on CNBC. You got a stock tip for us today, John?
Well, at the 52-week low today, we were buying Select Comfort. These are the guys, of course, with those air mattresses that basically cost about the same as a high-end mattress, but they have adjustables for either side of the bed and so forth. Famously, many of us have seen those commercials. The stock has just been on its backside for most of this year, hit a new 52-week low today, and we saw big institutions coming in and buying it down there, Steve. So under $20 a share, it's already made a little bit of a 2% or more rebound from that. But that one looks very attractive to me. It's, I believe, $14 under the 52-week high, and just set a new 52-week low today.
That's John Najarian live at the New York Stock Exchange this afternoon. John, thanks for taking the time to join us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right, safe travels. You're listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. When we come back, we will be joined by Michael Lewis, the writer. You know, he wrote The Blind Side, great movie. He wrote Moneyball, turned into a very good movie. Well, he also wrote the book The Big Short, about some guys who made billions of dollars on the housing crisis beginning, I think it was around 2007, maybe even they started a little bit before that. But this movie, The Big Short, just out today in Chicago. He wrote the book, and we will kick it around next on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Whoever said you can't make a good movie from a good book never read Michael Lewis, Moneyball, The Blind Side, and now The Big Short. Time and again, what works on the page for Lewis works on the screen for Hollywood. Michael Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start. The Big Short follows these investors who, what, in 2007 saw that the housing boom was about to collapse, was going to take the economy with it. Was it 2007?
Started seeing the earliest started to track it in about 2005, And there were these guys who were kind of oddballs on the fringes of the system who were asking questions about the loans that were being made that the people making the loans weren't asking. And the story tells, it's the story of these people who really knew nothing about the market to start with. They were innocent about it, figuring out what was going on in the heart of our financial system.
And when did you see, how did you find this story?
I found it because once I, I was reading in the newspapers in 2007, like everybody else, that all of a sudden, you know, Morgan Stanley had lost $10 billion on a bet and Citigroup had $30 billion in losses. And I was wondering what these losses were. I realized that they were losses on basically a zero-sum bet that these firms had made against people. And I wondered who on earth was on the other side of this bet? Who's made billions on the other side? And when you ask that question of people on Wall Street, eventually you get to the answer. It was like a list of 15 people who were doing this in a big way, and I went and found them and talked to them and figured out who the best to write the book about were.
It seems to me, and this is just a guess really, but it seems to me that these are all sort of oddballs in their own way that allowed them to look at things a little differently. Is that fair or unfair?
That in the case, there are three major characters in the movie and the book, and each of them was viewing the world in a really peculiar way. I mean, for example, one of the teams was looking to, they had the view that people generally like completely underestimate the likelihood of really horrible things happening, and they had made bets in all kinds of places about really horrible things happening, and they just happened with that, viewing the world through that weird prism. Stumble upon the subprime mortgage bond market, and so that they and got to learn about it for that reason. But they had a reason for kind of looking at the world for problems. And one of the other characters, played by Christian Bale, Michael Burry, he had Asperger's syndrome. He didn't talk to people. He didn't listen to the propaganda on Wall Street. He just looked at the numbers. And when you actually get into the what's inside the bonds and you look at the loans, you realize, oh my God, these loans are horrible. They each had a different kind of weird perspective on the world. And the bigger point is that weird perspective was missing in the big Wall Street institutions.
Right. They didn't have enough weird to see what was going to happen.
It's actually right. It was too very conformist kind of groupthink. Everybody kind of agreeing on a truth when the truth was much more complicated.
All right. So let's enter then, or let's talk about Adam McKay, because the book is out. The book does well. And then Hollywood comes calling again. Adam McKay, known for Anchorman, Talladega Nights, films like that. When you first heard his name, what were your thoughts?
Well, I happen to think, I didn't know Adam McKay, but I happen to think Talladega Nights is a work of genius. And so I thought, and I know how hard comedy is. And I thought, actually, if he can do this, that, maybe he can find a way to actually make the financial crisis entertaining, that he can actually bring it to life. And when I found out he had a real interest and knowledge in the subject, I thought it's not going to be a problem. It turned out to be true. He's the perfect man for the job. He did an incredible thing in turning the book into a movie, which I didn't imagine was going to happen.
You know, I'm sitting in Chicago where there's been a lot of talk in the past 6 months about Spike Lee and his book Chirac. And the idea was that was a satire of a very serious problem, violence in the black community. Is The Big Short, as it's made by Adam McKay, is that satire or is it just a funny way to tell the story?
You know, it's a funny way to tell the story. Because it isn't really distorting things. In fact, he's incredibly close to the book, in especially the drawing of the characters. So it's satire in the sense that it's sharp, humorous social commentary, and it's dealing with a serious problem. But it's not. I think of it as a genre busting. It happens to be a very funny movie that's a tragedy, which is an odd combination.
The phrase "it'd be funny if it wasn't so sad" keeps coming to mind, but it turns out it's funny too.
Yes, and it's funny. I've often thought this in the books, in the things I've written, and also in the watching the movies, like The Blind Side. Funny and sad are not that far apart. They're closer together than not feeling anything. And when if you've got an audience that's laughing, you get them laughing. You can also hit them with other emotions because you've stirred up their emotional juices. And that's what he does. He uses the humor to get you feeling things. And then when you're feeling things, you start to feel other things.
I like that idea. I hadn't thought of it before. But humor and laughter sort of elevates you, sort of puts you higher up on the cliff to bring for the sadness to bring you down.
It gets you in an emotional state. And that's what often in a comedy, it just keeps you in that emotional state. And in this case, he shifts the emotional state. And so it turns out it's easier to shift into another emotional state from laughter than it is from no feeling at all.
Michael Lewis is on the phone line. He is the author of The Big Short and so many others, really. Moneyball, Blind Side, Coach, which was one of my favorites.
Mine too.
Yeah. You know, the Coach was this story. I think the subtitle was sort of like Lessons in Life, and it was from maybe your high school coach and what you took out of his lessons to you.
Yeah, it was a really powerful character. It was about how a teacher changes a kid's life.
Yeah, it's a nice book. People should pick that up. Well, what's the next one they'll pick up? What are you working on now?
I can't tell you.
Yeah, you can.
I'm writing it, and I jinx it if I talk about it. But I can tell you it will be out in December. But I'm in the middle of it. I'm in the middle of it, and I'm feeling good.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're feeling good about it, at least. We'll wait. We'll probably find out in a few months anyway. Michael, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:39. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Tuesday, December 22nd. Christmas just around the corner. Louis Lazar from the Chicago Business Journal is here. Welcome to the program, Louis.
Thank you.
And it used to be, we've been talking off the air here, but the theater news sort of the day is the fact that the Red Moon Theater closed, right? Just shut the doors.
Finished.
Yeah. They announced it, and that was it.
25 years, it's over, just in a heartbeat yesterday afternoon.
And it's just too bad. I took a couple cracks at them, right? They had trouble with the Great Chicago Fire Fest,
right,
but they always were trying things.
Well, yeah, they were more about being in the neighborhoods, you know, which inevitably lowered their profile as sort of not in the same realm as Steppenwolf or Goodman.
Sure.
We were downtown and have high visibility, so they never got the name recognition to the same degree that some of the other theater companies. But they claimed they were in the neighborhood doing good things. So
didn't they do a puppet show against the Museum of Contemporary Art maybe 10 years ago or so?
Well, you may be right. I don't recall it.
I feel that. Well, I asked.
They've done a lot of those type of shows over their 25 years.
It was always spectacle and sort of a unique Chicago thing, and it's just too bad. But was it the Fire Fest that did them in?
Well, that was, I think, the final straw. I mean, apparently they'd been overreaching for some time, and their finances just didn't keep up with their overhead, and it became a problem they couldn't resolve.
It got me to thinking, though, about, you know, we have Broadway in Chicago, which is great. They're bringing shows in, and, you know, Hamilton, the news of Hamilton coming in is great.
Right, and they all get tax breaks, by the way, all these shows that are headed to New York that come to Chicago to try out, like Gotta Dance is doing at the moment,
right,
at the Bank of America Theater, they advertise that in the program. They're thanking Governor Rauner for the tax breaks they're getting to try out the show here.
Well, are you going to give us a review of Gotta Dance?
Well, I would say if you've got better something else to do, you might want to think about it.
Okay.
It's not where it needs to be yet, let's put it that way.
Which is why it's here, maybe, right?
Right. Well, yeah, they're trying to make some improvements.
Well, what I'm interested in, there was a time when Chicago was known as this, you know, a theater capital, not New York, but a theater. And they were, and I'm thinking of their theaters that are still around. I mean, the Royal George, the Briar Street, Steppenwolf, obviously. But not, so Steppenwolf isn't quite what I'm thinking about. One maybe notch below in size or draw. They used to really thrive, and they kind of went away, and I've kind of forgot that they've even gone away.
Well, there are still, I wouldn't say a lot, but a number of storefront theaters, which used to be the bread and butter
Timeline
of Chicago
is one,
theaters.
Right,
yeah, I mean, they're even a little bigger than storefront at this point. But the fact of the matter is, if you really scratch the surface, you'll find that a lot of these companies that are still remaining are what they call volunteer operations. Literally, everybody's doing it for the love of theater. They're not bringing home a penny, let alone an earning that they can live on.
Which is too bad. Because what happens then is that one of the only options becomes the highest end option,
right,
which
the big
keeps,
ticket,
yeah,
downtown
keeps more
stuff.
People from experiencing theater.
Right. And certainly if you're in a family experience, it becomes a very big ticket by the time you pay for four or five tickets and the parking and the food. Parking in this town has really skyrocketed. Right. Thank you, Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
And you know, I did not think of this until this moment, but I just brought my, when you said family, we went to Second City on Sunday, which I, you know, I didn't even put in that list because it's been so long and it's kind of different, but that was a great show. One of the better ones I've seen a number of the reviews and really enjoyed that. That's always going to be around, I guess.
Right, and that's a little more accessible. And you say the ticket is more reasonable, but they've always focused on being very reasonable and accessible, at least for the kind of show they are.
Jason Lesnevich from True Chicago was in last week, and we were talking about Bel Canto, the opera, which is, it's just an odd feeling because, in a way, it's almost, it's a fictionalized version of the attack in Paris, the theater there that was written 15 years before the attack
exactly.
in Paris.
And even the production photos they're distributing, Lyric Opera of Chicago, I mean, it's sort of, it is a little creepy because they show these terrorists in this little mansion setting, you know, with their guns pointed at the opera diva that's one of the characters in the show.
How's it doing?
Well, you know, I can't say specifically. I think they're getting an audience. I don't know whether everybody wants to do terrorist opera at Christmas time, but...
But it's getting a boost, right? It's going to be in great performances?
It will be at some point about probably 6 to 8 to 10 months from now, it should be.
And so how does that work? Do they make money on that, or what's that about?
Well, Lyric won't make a penny, unfortunately. They'll get the visibility from the television,
or several
television appearance, but they're not getting any revenue from it, unfortunately, other than what they would get from the people coming to see. It will be taped early next month in front of a live audience, so they'll get the revenue from the people in the audience, but that's it.
Those are the things I want to talk about when it came to theater, and we've got a minute or so. So you also wrote about Kroger this year being the big grocery player in the country, buying the company that owns Mariano's, and you intimate that maybe they might replace Mariano's. Tell me about that.
I would say it's a very good bet because the Kroger is a huge brand nationally. A lot of their stores are in the southeastern United States, but they're a well-known brand.
I think they're in Kankakee County, too.
With the Kroger brand? Okay.
When I was a kid.
Then they're close. They're nipping at our heels. But I think, you know, Chicago being the third largest market in the country, it would make sense for them to want to put their core brand in the city. So, I mean, the question is, do you just wipe out the Mariano's, which only been around for 5 years? I mean, some people might think it's been around forever, but in the grand scheme of things, that's not a long time.
But couldn't you do both?
You could, but then they sort of have to start building out new stores. So this would be a cheaper way to get the Kroger brand itself in the market. They could choose that option, but my hunch is they might go with
it. It just seems to me they're a little different product. I mean, Mariano's.
Well, I don't know. My first impression, I mean, I grew up in a town the Kroger was the centerpiece in Kentucky.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, when I first walked into a Mariano's, it had the same vibe as the Kroger in the hometown where I grew up in, you know, but that's just my impression.
All right. Louis Lazar, the Chicago Business Journal. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Have a great
Happy
Christmas.
Holidays.
Yeah, we'll
you
see
too.
You next year.
Thank
You're listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Orion Samuelson, Ryan Burrow, and Dolly McCarthy. Andrew Herman is here from DNA Info Chicago, where we talk about what's opening, what's closing in the city of Chicago. Andrew, welcome to the program.
I like to sort of focus on the openings rather than the closings.
Well,
Sounds like you've got that covered.
On the closings?
Yeah.
So
on the Red Moon, I mean.
I know. We were talking about Red Moon Theater earlier, and that sort of segues into another theatrical spectacle that's coming to Chicago. Because over my shoulder, and you notice it, across the river.
Right.
Would that be at the Hyatt, maybe?
Yeah, that's the Hyatt. That's Chi-Town Rising, which is not working out the way they thought it was going to. At first, it was going to be this big free festival, and then all of a sudden, over the weekend, I saw that that they're going to be charging more for tickets now, and it's becoming something else. And it was interesting, the story I was reading in the Tribune, and it seems like if you read between the lines, there's been, you know, some back and forth with the city about whether or not you can throw a private outdoor party.
I've been picking up some of the people here off the air talking about it too, that there's, but here's this giant star now that is attached, and it's not Crystal, but our star is bigger than New York.
Yeah.
That might be the only thing.
Yeah.
So we're hoping for a big party on New Year's Eve, I guess.
We'll see how all that turns out.
I would imagine you're going to be down here.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it.
So get this. In the mail today, I got a ViewMaster.
We got one of those at DNAinfo.com Chicago ourselves.
First, Yuntai opens it up. It actually was to him, and we're looking at it. And it's for this rooftop bar that's opening up at the Renaissance Hotel downtown. Uh-huh. Coincidentally, we had already talked about something that was what we were going to kick around today.
Right.
So if you don't mind, I'm just going to go through the slides here. And
you know, the funny thing is, it came in the mail, and some of our reporters are so young at DNA Info, he didn't know what it was. He said,
right.
How am I going to get these images out of this device and onto the website?
Oh, it's a really toy, had never boy. Seen. It's a toy.
I know. I used to love those things when I was a kid, though. Appealing to the nostalgia, obviously, that they thought existed in newsrooms. But you know what? They're a lot younger today.
It's too old for that.
Yeah.
But anyway, the idea is that this new hotel is being built, and they're all about what's inside. But what I like about it is there's going to be another, looks like, great outdoor rooftop bar downtown.
Yeah, this is at the Renaissance, 1 West Wacker, you know, fire pits outside. This might not be the perfect weather for it, but they plan on opening in March, and it's joining a number of other rooftop bars that have opened this year.
So like, the Trump one is the one I know of.
That one's been around, obviously, for a while, but the Virgin Hotel has one. I've been to that one. That's very nice. Air, which is at the Hyatt Centric at 100 West Monroe. That's on the 24th floor. That is pretty cool, too. And there's a place called Cindy's, and that's at the Chicago Athletic Association. That's on 12 South Michigan.
Cindy's?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, they turned that into a hotel now, the Chicago Athletic Association.
Oh, no, I did not know.
Yeah,
that.
And they've built this beautiful restaurant and bar, and it has these beautiful views of the lake and Millennium Park, and these rooftop bars, they're kind of hand in hand with the explosion of hotels down here.
Well, you know, I've been to New York several times on business, and when I would go, the hotels often would have a rooftop bar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very cool thing, and it's about time we start getting it catching up there.
Right. So we've had 8 new hotels built in Chicago in downtown area, or the downtown area this year. 2,400 rooms in 2015.
Wow. They're building a lot of hotel rooms, a lot of apartments.
Yeah, three more coming in 2016.
That's Andrew Herman from DNA Info Chicago. Okay, let's go to Little Italy, mm-hmm. where anyone who knows the city knows you go for a nice plate of lasagna and a marijuana pipe.
Well, a lot of people know about the Italian restaurants, Rosebud and Stefani's over there.
Right.
And, you know, just
Vernon Park Tech.
Awesome
right?
places, yeah. But now it's becoming a smoke shop. Center. There's 2 new smoke shops now. There are also cigar places. Sight and Sound is opened at 1137 West Taylor, and Pipes and Stuff at 1300 West Taylor. A couple more Ralph Cigars, Sinbad Hookah, have been there for a while. And as you point out, they not only sell cigars, but they also sell vaporizers, you know, these vape for people who like to vape, the e-cigs. But it has become kind of a sub industry over there.
Well, from what I read in the article in DNA Info is that, you know, they're all, some of these shops are almost complementary. Like you've got the Old World Cigar Shop, and then you got the vape shop nearby. But what struck me is not just the boon there, but that they're selling these. First of all, they're selling pipes that when we were younger were illegal to sell.
Right.
Right. You couldn't. Yeah. That was called a head shop, and they shut all of those down in the 70s and 80s. But now they're charging thousands and thousands of dollars for some of these pipes.
Yeah, there's one there, shop there, Sight and Sound, has a $20,000 glass pipe.
Well,
it looks like a piece of art that you would have in your, you know, very fine living room. But
it's obvious, Andrew, but you would have to be high to spend that much money.
Now, I think people are looking at smoking tobacco a little different than maybe we did. It's you know, they get high-end tobaccos, and I don't know.
Well, there was a hookah salesman around here too, right?
But that's true too. So maybe they're just taking that cue from Colorado, and they know that legalized marijuana is going to come sooner or later, and they're trying to get their foot in the door.
It's a fascinating thing. He sold one for $5,000, then he's got one or two in there for $20,000.
Well, cigar smoking is taking off too. You know, cigarettes are down, cigar smoking is up. So, and you know, with the opening of Cuba, that might even get even larger. People might even get more into cigars.
All right, I'll meet you down there, Andrew.
Okay, Andrew, stay away from the glass pipes, though. All right,
I will stay away from the glass pipes.
Okay.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.